Blind Nil Audio.
Today on 50 Fires, my conversation with actor Dean Norris.
Money was just a function of how many months I could go without working.
Dean is best known for his role as Hank in the blockbuster TV show Breaking Bad. But as you'll hear today, it's not about money for Dean.
So I never bought a car that I couldn't afford. I never bought a house that I couldn't afford. It ended up being, for me at least, a pretty good way of living life. There was never a moment where I was like, I have no money. What am I going to do?
That and so much more coming up today on 50 Fires. Greetings, Carl here. My guest today is Dean Norris. Dean grew up in Indiana, got a scholarship to go to Harvard, and then decided to pursue a career in acting. And as he acknowledges in this conversation, there aren't many careers that are more risky than acting. And because of that, early on in his career, he intentionally decided to approach money in a way that enabled him to continue being an actor. He'd get paid for a movie, and then figure out how many months he could go without working until he needed to get another job. And that's been the principle that has run throughout Dean's career. As success came, and he's had it, especially when he landed the role of Hank in Breaking Bad, he's used his money as a tool to enable the things he wanted to see in the world. So let's dive right in. I'm Carl Richards, an author, artist, and proud financial planner. And today we're talking about money with Dean Norris. This is 50 Fires, a podcast about money and meaning. Tell me, I mean, before we like dive in, how did they convince you to do this?
I thought the topic was a really interesting one, to be honest with you, because it is something that is so integral to our lives, but everyone's afraid to talk about it.
What were you taught in terms of how to, like, what were you modeled in terms of how to talk about money? Anything?
Well, I think I was raised in a time where, you know, nobody asked what your, you know, how much money you made. And you weren't supposed to ask how much money somebody made. But it was really important in our family. I came from a kind of a lower middle class family where money was every day was, my dad was a salesman, a furniture salesman. So every day was either a good day or a bad day if you sold a lot of furniture. You know what I'm saying?
Right, right.
You sold the bedroom set, it was good. If you only sold a mattress, it was less good. But they always kind of kept, my parents always kind of kept that away from us as kids. It wasn't until I was older that I realized more that, you know, that my mom had a second job. And I didn't really think we were disadvantaged until I got to Harvard.
Yeah.
And then I realized, oh, wow, there's some people that make a lot of money in this world. So they kind of kept it away, the, I guess we call it the struggles or the concerns about money. They kind of kept that to themselves until I got older, you know what I'm saying? So I never felt that. But I did know from an early age, I had a piggy bank and I was supposed to save money. And I started working at 14 and I was very conscious of, you know, saving money and making money. I had a lot of money by the time I had a band in high school. So I had a relative, you know, I had a money and money market accounts when I was 18 years old, you know.
How did you know you were lower to middle class?
Because I realized that people were there. You start to realize that there were neighborhoods with a lot bigger houses, you know, than when you were riding your bike around at 4, 5, 6 years old. And then at some point, you realize that the doctors and lawyers lived in a different area, you know, and you're like, oh, okay. And then, like I said, when I got to Harvard, it was clear that there were people that came from very wealthy families. Although Harvard had a lot of blue collar, let's say, kids, because they let a lot of kids in. It's blind. Its admissions is financially blind. So you get in or you don't get in. And then if you get in, they make sure you can afford you to go there. So I basically went there for free.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you remember like riding your bike around as a kid? Do you remember noticing like, wow, this is a different neighborhood?
Yeah, because I remember we moved when I was 5 years old to what was considered a better school district area. But it was just on the edge. And I know there was a stretch for my parents to get there. But as life continued, they would build bigger developments. So you would actually ride through your kind of neighborhood and then there's a new street. You know, and you're like, oh, let's go down that street. And then you would go down that street and those houses were a lot bigger, you know, and nicer. And then, you know, 4 years later, 3 years later, there'd be another street. Oh, let's check out that street, you know. Then there became neighborhoods that were known to be wealthier neighborhoods in your suburb. You know what I'm saying? I was raised in South Bend, Indiana. So moving outside of downtown area, you know, moved into quote unquote the suburbs. So it was always this interesting thing. Yeah, there'd be like a new road and like, oh, wow, that's a new road. You pedal over there and you go, wow. I used to play in the dirt over there and now it's a subdivision, you know.
Yeah. If you had to summarize your beliefs around money early in life with one word, what word would you use?
Geez, it might be frugality, but I think it would also be, I'm going to say like freedom or what do you think the word would be? The ability to, it's not one word, so there must be one word for it.
No, you can go with more than one word.
Freedom from having to worry about money.
So freedom and frugality.
Yeah, one of those two words that,
Hey, it's Carl here. I've got to jump in. Like, wow, that is interesting. The first word that Dean used was frugality, but then he quickly said freedom. And I don't know if he meant this necessarily, but it is really interesting to see the link. Often we think of frugality as restrictive, you know, this like cage or box that we put ourselves into. But it's interesting to think about frugality being intentional about our use of money, maybe not spending in one area, the idea that that opens up all sorts of possibilities in other areas, right? Like frugality could give us freedom. That's super interesting.
One of those two words that, because that's what it equaled to me was, you know, can you go on this vacation? Can you go here? Can you just, you know, hang out at home this week, whatever the deal is, without having money be an issue in the back of your mind and making money, obviously.
So good. It's really interesting that that came at such an early age and maybe like just interesting that there wasn't a lot of conversation in the house like normal about money.
Yeah.
I don't remember anybody talking about it when I was growing up.
No.
But that you came to that conclusion is really cool.
I think I felt it. Like, for instance, my sister's never felt it, I don't think. But I, as the boy, felt that I kind of could feel, you know, that my dad was stressed about having to go to work all the time.
Like, can you remember a specific instance?
I just can remember starting to feel that they were more worried about money as I got to be in college and stuff. So I always felt like I had this burden. They never put it on me at all. But I took on the burden of having to kind of take care of my family, meaning my mom and dad, you know what I'm saying? And I remember the first big movie I got, I made a pretty good, you know, six-figure sum. And then I got another one right after. And my mom, you know, wrote me a letter or something about saying, oh, your dad is really, you know, bummed out because the furniture store is not going well and blah, blah, blah. Mm. So I literally went home with my little bit of money and took over that store and turned it into a Western wear store.
Stop it.
And it's a long story because it was in the industrial Midwest, and everything after 72, the oil crash, everything just crashed. That's what became the Rust Belt. South Bend, Indiana was part of that. So all the downtowns were just bled out and everybody went to the suburbs. The malls came along. We had our first mall when I was in high school. So everybody started shopping out at the giant furniture stores and stuff out there. And my dad had this old store downtown. So I had to figure out, not knowing anything about business, how I could save that. And what I realized is that people would drive to a destination spot. And Western music, country music was getting real big then. People were line dancing and all this kind of stuff. And there weren't any big stores that had all the boots you want and all the outfits you want and all the hats you want. So I literally was in California. I would go to different Western stores and write down, there's no internet back then. And I would write down like the different brands and stuff. And then I get on the phone, I'd call 411 and I just pick towns like Nashville or, you know, Houston. Do you have a number for Stetson? Do you have a number for blah, blah, blah? Finally, I got a few. I started this thing, Wrangler, and we just got all these things in and I started doing commercials, radio commercials on these country stations, and it became this big, we became the biggest country store in Northern Indiana.
Come on.
Without knowing anything about any of this stuff.
And your dad's still working there?
Yeah, he did until he passed away. And he was very, you know, angsty about it because he was you know, his dream of his furniture store wasn't working out, you know what I'm saying? Right. But my mom understood that we needed to do something. And sure enough, finally my dad came around to it and got a country suit and got a hat and started being a salesman again. And it saved their retirement. You know, it saved their, it like, we took a lot of money in that store. And I bought them a house out in California when they retired. And that was like literally the best thing I ever did in my life other than getting married and have my kids.
Wow.
In fact, until then, that was the best thing I ever did in my life was be able to take care of my parents, you know, so.
That's amazing, man.
And that's all about money.
Yeah. Thanks, by the way, for sharing that. That's really cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
Are you kidding me? That story is so good. Now, I know a little bit about Dean's career, and I'd never heard the story. In fact, I've heard from people who know him really well that had never heard the story. And it's so fascinating to hear him talk about that being the best thing he'd ever done in his life. Now, I realize, and we often have this problem, right? We often have this problem. We hear about a story or a number, and that may not be possible for all of us to go out and help our parents start a business. But what I think this is pointing to, and I think the far more important lesson, at least for me, is we get so distracted by what we think will bring us happiness in terms of our use of money. We think unnecessary plastic items, right? We think entertainment, maybe the new car, maybe the new bike, whatever it is. It turns out spending money on experiences with people that you love drives far more happiness. It doesn't have to be buying a store. It doesn't have to be buying a house. It could simply be a little bit of time, lunch with your mother, you know, a conversation with your sister. Spending time and money with the people that we love drives happiness way more than unnecessary plastic items. Is there any tradition or cultural piece that your parents passed down to you about money? Like, do you remember learning anything from them about money?
It was, I mean, other than you should save your money, which was a thing that I became obsessed with, you know, putting money in my piggy bank and then rolling them, you know, rolling all the pennies and the dimes and the stuff into rolls and take it to the bank and putting it in the bank. Yeah. And even when I started making more money and my parents were still alive, they were always like, you got to save your money, you know, which is good advice for an actor, by the way. especially now.
Right. I'm super curious about a word you used. You used a word obsessed with saving my money. Like, can you recall feeling that? Like, what was the, talk to me a little bit about being obsessed from a young age.
Yeah. I was taught to save money. I became more obsessed when I became on my own and I had chose this weird profession where nobody makes any money. And that's when I became more obsessed with it. You know what I'm saying? Because I knew I would measure my success and how many months I could go without working. You'd get a job and go, okay, that covers me for the next 3 months. And then another job covers me for the next 4 months. And pretty soon you're like, oh, I can go a year without working, you know? Money was just a function of how many months I could go without working.
Love that.
My frugality combined with the more money making allowed me to have X number more months of not having to work. You know what I'm saying? So I never bought a car that I couldn't afford. I never bought a house that I couldn't afford, like without even worrying about it. You know what I'm saying? I thought that was it ended up being, for me at least, a pretty good way of living life. And I never had a real... There was never a moment where I was like, I have no money. What am I going to do? You know what I'm saying?
Hey, it's Carl. We've got to stop just for a second because this is a very important concept and it's been really impactful for me personally. In fact, I've repeated this part of my conversation with Dean a number of times since we had it. This idea that money to Dean just equaled how many months he could go without working is so cool. In fact, there's a technical term and it may be my favorite measurement around money. Think of it as like a vital sign for money, like blood pressure, right? It's called liquid term. And liquid term, it's a little bit like the emergency fund idea you've heard. If you take the amount of money you could get your hands on really quickly, in finance, we would say that's liquid, right? That you could get your hands on pretty quickly. And you take that total and divide it by how much you spend per month. So let's say that you know, there's $60,000 liquid in like maybe a savings account and a checking account and something else you can get your hands on pretty quickly, $60,000. and you spend $5,000 a month. Well, that means you have a liquid term of 12 months or 1 year, right? And there's something really interesting going on in the world today. So many of us have lumpy incomes. So it's not just actors or creatives. So many of us have lumpy incomes now, right? We may be starting a business. You may be a contract employee. And so this idea to think about liquid term, like if you've got a really stable job with a lot of job security, well, your liquid term can be a little bit lower and you still feel okay. But if you've got a really lumpy income, you're a freelancer, a creative, an actor, well, I just noticed that you feel better if your liquid term is higher, right? Over one, maybe even two or three. So that tool has been really helpful for me. Dean was using that tool naturally. Like he had just created this model in his mind that between his frugality and this idea that money equaled how many months he could go without working, like that was really opening up to him the freedom to focus on his craft, right? So I just loved that framework. It's so interesting that you thought of that early on. Like you literally came up with the framework yourself of,
yeah,
I think about money in terms of how many months I can go without working. Where did that come from?
Just because you're scared that you're not going to have enough money to pay your rent or pay your car payment. And then you go, okay, I get a job. And it's like, okay, that's going to last me for X number of months. And this gives me a little bit of breathing room, you know? And if I had a job on top of that, it gives me a few more months. And then I had a job on top of that. And eventually you get to, for me personally as an actor, that the goal was always to, if I broke my leg and or something or could never work again, could I live off my residuals? You know what I'm saying? Right. That was always the goal. I think why people are striking right now, because residuals have gone away. They've gone to streaming and they're not getting their residuals. But it was always that kind of idea that, like, I mean, I remember at one point I was like, from a money point of view, I was as happy as could be, because I really figured that with residuals coming in, I could go like Europe for a year, come back and still have a year before I had to actually get a job. You know, and I really at a certain point never got a job, never didn't get a job. So then it became, at some point, it became something I didn't think about. But then what happens is you get married and you have kids, and now you have the frugality level is a whole different level. Right. So that's me, as a single guy. I can go for 2 years without working. Now I'm married with kids, and all of a sudden, ooh, the number has to go much higher to get your monthly nut, as we always used to talk about it as actors, you know. And we would talk, and actors talk about that stuff, you know.
Really?
I remember all my friends, like, what's your monthly nut? It's like, what's your monthly nut?
So really, that's actually a conversation, like this monthly nut conversation.
Yeah. Like, what do you have to make to survive every month? You know what I'm saying? And that number goes much higher when you're married with kids, you know, and it's more serious.
For sure.
Because, you know, at least as a single guy, but geez, if something ever happened, I could always wait tables or bartend or something like that, you know. But once you get into a certain lifestyle with your family and your kids, you're like, you know, things have got to work out better, you know. So
we'll be right back with more from 50 Fires. Hey, it's Carl. You know what's hard for most of us? Talking money. That's what I'm talking about. Talking about money is hard for most of us, but there's somebody who it is not hard for. She's been doing it forever. Her name is Shauna Game. And if you've been enjoying the conversations I'm having here at 50 Fires, I think you would love what Shauna's got going on at her podcast. The podcast is called Everyone's Talking Money. And just like 50 Fires, Shauna's goal with Everyone's Talking Money is to go beyond the spreadsheets and the calculators and the budgeting apps to talk about how our emotional relationship with money impacts our lives. With over 900 episodes, that's right, 900, there is an episode for any and every practical money question you have. Some of Shauna's recent episodes include retirement risks to avoid, and credit card versus debit card, which one should I use? You're going to love it. Subscribe to Everyone's Talking Money on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome back to 50 Fires. It was so fascinating. Like, how does a guy that would use the word obsessed about saving money decide that it's a good idea to become an actor?
Yeah, that was a huge, obviously, decision and a weird, you know, you talk about the role of art in your life and the role of what do you really want to do in your life? And it didn't really intersect with making money. You know, I remember I used to, at the end of my senior year, I would have, there would be a lot of financial institutions that would be interested in hiring you, like, you know, the big banks and all that stuff. Right. They would always come to Harvard. So I would have them, I would take interviews with them in New York, and they would fly me down, put me up in a nice hotel. I'd go do the interview, and then I'd change into my jeans and t-shirt and go audition for stuff in New York.
Wow.
So I would take, I'd do whatever I did in the interview, you know, blah, blah, blah. And on one of those trips, I auditioned for the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art in London, and I got in, and I said, shit, if I get in here, you know, I was super wondering, as every actor does, you know, are you good enough to make it in the business? You know what I'm saying?
Mm.
And so I kind of got in there, and they had one scholarship for an American, and I got it. And so I was able to go to London, go to the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art. And so I said, okay, you know, I remember making that decision. And there was a professional theater there called the American Repertory Theater. So I got to understudy a lot of those guys and hang out with a lot of those actors that were professional actors. And I remember thinking to myself, on the side of the stage wearing some codpiece, you know, waiting to go out in front of a crowd of, you know, 800 people that just, you know, laughed their ass off. It was the best feeling in the world. I said, if I can at least do as well as these guys in the American Repertory Theater, they had, you know, they had a place to stay. They had a house. They seemed like they had fun. They had a great life. I said, I'd be happy. And so that I kind of made that decision, you know, and then I came back and then it was a huge leap to go to LA and start doing stuff. You know,
how did you make that decision?
Well, I went to New York and I got my first job in New York on the Equalizer. And I was like, this isn't that hard. And that allowed me to get an agent who had a representation on the West Coast. So I knew I had an agent when I came to the West Coast. And that's really what made that decision to leave the East Coast, because I had someone that on the West Coast that would, you know, put me up for jobs and stuff. And luckily, I got some early jobs there. And I remember getting about 6 months in, I got Lethal Weapon 2, which is my first big movie. And I remember I was waiting tables at Hamburger Hamlet, and my agent called and go, hey, you got it. And it was like something like, you know, like 13 weeks at $3,000 a week. I was like, wow. Are you serious?
Right.
And, you know, I was probably making $600 a week as a waiter. And I said, are you sure? I said, yes, it's sure. It's guaranteed, blah, blah, blah. I literally took my apron off, you know, and said, here you go. That burger goes there. That one goes there. And that one goes there. I'll see you guys later.
Stop it.
And I never had to work again.
Was Lethal Weapon 2 the one with the drive-through? You always get screwed in the drive-through.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that was so funny because then the 13 weeks, talk about money, 13 weeks turned into 16 weeks turned into 19 weeks. And I had I just randomly had one of my good friends on there who had been in a few things. And I would sit there in my trailer. And we kind of, it was actually within my trailer, it was a little box room. I forgot what they call them. And I'm sitting there all day. And I'm like, go to my friend Nestor. I go, hey, man, what's the deal? We're sitting here all day, you know? He says, yeah. But, you know, these guys make so much money that by the time they took to figure out whether they needed you or not, they just round that off. So he's like, you know, just in case they need you. Because we would sit there for weeks and not work.
Well,
like at the place. He's like, just in case they need us, you know, because they get to that scene and we're not here. You know how much money that would cost them to make that? I was like, shit, well, I think they're paying me a lot of money. He's like, no.
Right.
$3,000 a week is not a lot of money in the Lethal Weapon 2 business, you know.
Amazing.
Yeah.
While this was going on, because I've run into a few people and I kind of feel like you might be one of them. Like, were you thinking about money as you were making these decisions?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, I don't, I didn't have the luxury of not thinking about money. But fortunately, you know, I was able to do these big action films that then paid back in the residual. So 2 years later, 3 years later, I get my first check in the mail from Lethal Weapon 2, you know, and it's like, you know, $26,000 or something. I'm like, this is a great business. And I had done, you know, a bunch of those, Lethal Weapon 2, Hard to Kill, Total Recall. And they were all movies that took, back in the day, would take 2-3 months to make. I think Total Recall took almost 6 months or 5 months at least. Wow. So you're on this, you're on the payroll, you know, again, just a rounding error for the producers. But for you, it's like good money, you know, every week, you know. And then on top of that, you would start getting the residuals coming in, and it was a nice, it was a good, it was good to get that kind of feeling of, oh, okay, I'm, you know, that's when I kicked in the frugality in terms of I only spent as much money as I knew I had. I didn't spend as much money as I thought I was going to make. You know what I'm saying?
Interesting. Yeah.
I didn't have to have the stress that my dad had of worrying about money, you know, because I had enough. I lived within my means of what I was making at the moment. So.
Yeah. And that was a conscious decision.
Yeah.
Like disciplined, you were paying attention to it. You were.
Yeah.
What did that is such an important concept. The idea of only spending what you make now and not spending based on what you're projected to make, really, really important and really hard. In fact, there's a behavioral finance term, recency bias, where we take the recent past and we project it indefinitely into the future. And it leads to chaos because if you think like, oh, every year I get a bonus in December. My year-end bonus every year. I mean, it's been 3 years in a row I've gotten a year-end bonus. Well, it'd be really easy in October or November, if you're thinking about buying a new house, to maybe include the idea that, well, every year I get it. It's been 2 years. So surely in December, I'm going to get a year-end bonus. And factor that into the decision on what house to buy. And then something changes, right? And what Dean's pointing to here is like, no, 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 I didn't do that. I based my spending on the money I had, right? The money I was currently making, not on some projection in the future, which by the way, is like something I personally struggle with. This idea of, oh, things are going to be great next year. Things are going to be great next year. And it was a really great reminder, sort of a grounding, if you will, of like, no, let's just be here now and let's spend based on that. What would be the most meaningful story about the feeling of receiving the money? Like, I'm curious about that first residual check, or like, can you remember a time when you held like the first time where you're like, whoa, this means something to me?
That was it. The first big Lethal Weapon 2 check, and literally came in the mail, you know, what we call mailbox money.
And you didn't know it was like, you didn't know what the number was, or?
I had no idea what the status of that would be. Well, what the level of that would be. I never, you know, that was my first job. So I hadn't gotten any residual checks yet, you know. And I remember my same buddy that I was talking to on the set, he said, trust me, I think I had turned down some other job on because of the Lethal Weapon 2 kept going and going. And I was like, damn it, I could have had this other job. He goes, trust me, Dean, you know, in a couple of years, you're going to be glad you had this job, you know. And he was right, because those checks keep coming. Those checks come to this day. It's 30 years later. And I still get paid for Lethal Weapon 2. You know, it's crazy. So that first check was like, oh my God. There's this concept of residuals that could possibly buy me a lot of time. And they did, you know, in terms of that kind of context I talked to you about of how much time do I have before I need my next job.
Yeah.
But you never knew when they were coming, and you never knew what they would be for. And some of them would be very big, some of them would be small. But after a while, after doing 150 shows and, 50 movies, it became a nice little, regular salary, if you will.
Was this freedom, this ability, like money equaled how many months I could go without working, was that so you could be selective about projects? Or was it just so that if they didn't come?
It was more so if they didn't come. I think even Al Pacino, I've read an interview where he's like, it's the most insecure business in the world, you know? And you know, you just, that's always stuck with you is that, I mean, luckily every month somebody would hire me to do a movie, and then there was the TV movies, and then there was the TV shows, and then there's, and it always happened. But when it ends, you just don't know when the next one's going to come. You know what I'm saying? And then I got to the point where I could be a little more selective because I was getting offered more stuff and I could pick that or pick that. But no, without a doubt, the actors talk about, you know, you live to act or you act to live. And I was definitely an act to live guy. I mean, I love acting, but I definitely did it as a job.
Yeah. Well, how did things, so you had, right, you were working for 20 years, all these action films, and then you're suddenly Hank at Breaking Bad.
Yeah.
How did that change things financially? Like, make sense of that for me.
Yeah, that I tell people that was like, it wasn't like going from 0 to 60, but it was going from like 25 to 60, you know, in a single jump. Because obviously I'd done a couple pilots and I saw what being a regular on a TV show meant, you know, and it was pretty good. So then that show came along and that just happened to be just a brilliant mixture of like the best thing I've ever read. And it somehow turned out to be a success because we all thought that, you know, it was just too good to be on TV. No one would get it. We wouldn't get the ratings and blah, blah, blah. But after the third year, that's when we all renegotiated. And that became then that's when I really felt that I was not wealthy, but rich. I think wealthy, you have to accumulate lots of other things. But I finally felt that, oh, man, I had kind of made it in the business, you know, and then that just turned into a big old thing. And it's more popular now than it was 15 years ago, you know, so that's kind of continued on in its popularity. But for money, for sure, it became completely relaxed. And by that time I was, you know, married, had a couple more kids. In fact, one of my kids was born during Breaking Bad. In fact, I think he wouldn't talk about an interesting money thing. We had that talk whether we're going to have our fourth child or not, and it was like, yeah, you know, we're, you know, Breaking Bad, you know, money wise has allowed us to have another child. Yeah. So in a way, a kind of a life was determined about. So that was then I never, you know, that was a different level of stuff, particularly by the end of it, and then you just could get offered regular jobs all the time after that, you know.
Yeah, two things I can't miss, like that distinction between wealthy and rich. That's fascinating. Can you talk more about that distinction you've made?
Yeah, I think, you know, you're rich because you can buy a nice big house and a nice car and all that stuff. But to have sort of like generational wealth, I guess your house is part of that. But to be the P&G guy, you know, that's wealthy. You think you make a lot of money until you see what the producers and types like that make. You know what I'm saying? And I'm certainly satisfied. Completely satisfied with what I make now, but you definitely notice that even if you do make a lot or a fair amount of money, there are people that, you know, have accumulated, you know, the Waltons of the world, you know, with like five of the top 20 people are, you know, descendants of Sam Walton, you know, in terms of money in America. It gets to be really concentrated, I think, in this country, I guess in every country. Yeah, you know, it's going off on a different tangent, but, you know, the ratio between what average people make to their bosses is, as I'm sure you've seen, you know, such a different category. It's in a different range now than it's ever been, you know. So anyway, that's what I mean between, you know, rich and wealthy.
Yeah. Are you satisfied?
I think I am. Now I'm concentrated on my kids, for instance, you know. And I recently bought this restaurant and some other stuff. And the reason for that is because that is an investment. I think that when I die, they have this property that's going to be worth a lot of money. You know what I'm saying? My residuals would not take care of them. And if I'm not around to get jobs, it wouldn't help. And I'm like, I just think that's the next logical step, is that trying to generate, you know, through, you know, buying and investing things, money that my kids then have some kind of core net worth when I'm gone, you know, or even when I'm here, maybe.
I don't know if you felt this way, but I felt slightly unmoored during this part of my conversation with Dean, just sort of trying to get some ground underneath my feet in terms of how I feel about rich versus wealthy and that idea. And the conclusion I came to was that money Whether you refer to it as being rich or being wealthy, money is relative, right? Dean points this out as well. Like, we're just always comparing. You know, you think you, I think Dean said, you think you make a lot of money until you see the, you know, whatever types and how much they make. But this idea between rich and wealthy, it is really just a relative discussion. Because I am sure, I'm positive that the fact that you're listening to this episode means there's somebody in the world that would think you are both rich and wealthy, right? And you may be looking at somebody else saying, oh, I'm not, they are. In fact, one thing that's really interesting over my career, 25 years of having this discussion, I've run into very few people who call themselves wealthy. Very few people. I've had this conversation with people who own airplanes and they don't call themselves wealthy. So I think this is a relative discussion. And so notice that about, at least I like to notice that about myself. Like, well, how am I comparing? What does wealth mean? And I loved Dean's response to like, are you satisfied? Well, I think I am. And we've noticed this a lot. In fact, in the conversation I had with Chip Gaines, we had to get to the same spot. Like, you, guess who gets to decide whether you're rich or wealthy? There's only one person, you. Is there anything I've been curious about, like Temecula and outside of LA, and like, have you intentionally made decisions to sort of be of the industry but not in the industry, or was that an important part of, was that a planned thing?
Yeah, absolutely. It's after I did my first series, which is down in Mexico, and I made some money, and I realized that my house, my little three-bedroom house in the Hollywood Hills, I would drive through from Mexico. I would drive through San Diego, then I'd stop in Temecula to get some coffee or whatever. And I was like, this is a cute little town. And then there'd be like these billboards up, like 4,500 square foot house, $440,000. So I got checked out. And I was like, wow, you know, this is amazing, you know? And I had my little three bedroom, you know, I think probably 1,200 square foot house in the Hollywood Hills. And it was worth, you know, $750,000. And I said, wow, I could sell this, you know, if I didn't have to be in LA. And the thing is, once I did that series down in Mexico, I didn't have to be in LA as much because people would just offer me some jobs. I didn't have to go and audition. Sometimes I would, but it was only an hour and a half. You know, people in New York would call that a daily commute, you know.
Right.
You know, I go, maybe I had to go in once a week or something like that. But I was able to move out, have this really nice house, really nice schools. And it was a great place to raise my kids. And I wanted them to feel like they were in a small town. Not, LA defines you. You know, when they get old enough, they can get into LA. I didn't want them to be kind of LA kids, if you would, you know. I wanted them to be like, kind of like where I came from in Southern Indiana, you know, a smaller town where they could feel more like they were, you know, I don't know, part of the town as much as they, you know, they go to school together and blah, blah, blah. And have kids they hang out with and stuff. And I lived, you know, in the Hollywood Hills, I didn't even know my neighbors, you know, I'd lived there for 6 years, you know, and it didn't seem like a place to raise kids.
I'm curious about the impact of the, and just your thoughts on money and the strike and like younger actors and like, just what do you see there that would be interesting to talk about?
It's such a brutal concept, particularly with younger actors who haven't got a big enough nest egg or the crews, you know, it's just brutal, brutal, brutal. But on the other hand, somebody did that in the 60s or 70s for me. And the residuals I got were very, very integral to my survival as a young actor. They were sometimes half my income, you know, in a year. But I guess it has to be done at some point, even though every time it happens, it's a nightmare for people who need that job the next month, you know, who need that job 3 months from now as actors, and particularly as crew people that don't, you know, they're living more paycheck to paycheck and stuff. So, you know, if we don't get money from streaming, some sort of residual concept, it's going to seriously harm a lot of people in the long run, you know.
Mm. If somebody landed 100 years from now and found just your financial transactions, you know, credit card statements, you know, whatever, your checkbook register in the old days, like, what would you hope they would say about you?
I hope they would say I balanced my budget.
Right.
I'm this guy who who lived within his means, you know.
Yeah.
And that meant living one way at one amount of money, and another way at another amount of money, and another way at another amount of money, but always within my means, you know.
Well, this has been amazing. I just have one last question. I mean, I have a million questions, but just for the sake of time, is your youngest a boy or a girl?
A boy.
And how old?
He's 15.
15. Okay. So let's just pretend, you know, 25 years from now, I'm still doing this show and we have him on. And what is he, 30? He's 40 years old.
Yeah.
Like, what would you hope he would say about what money means in his life? What would you hope he would say?
That's interesting. I mean, I hope, even though I felt that it really kind of turned me into the person I was because of the fear of it or the fear of not having it, I'm hoping he has whatever his, I hope he has respect for it, but maybe he didn't quite have that fear of it. And maybe he's able to be successful without that fear. Because I do want him to be, you know, like I said, respectful of the deal, of the idea of it. But maybe that he didn't grow up with as much anxiety about it, you know what I'm saying? But he was able then to frame his own world and whatever that was, and make it work for him, you know?
Yeah. I think I said that was the last question, but I lied. Just one more, because I asked you earlier, like, the one word for your early childhood. Like, if I were to ask you now, though, what does money mean to you now?
Now it means freedom, without a doubt. Mm. Yeah, freedom to not worry about it and freedom to not work.
And it's what's interesting to me is it's not because you don't like work.
No, I work way. I love work. You know?
Right. But the ability to not have to be like it directly linked to money. And, you know, let the rain show up when the rain shows up.
Yeah.
Amazing, Dean. Thanks.
Been a pleasure, man.
There's this phrase that I use all the time, and it's profit equals permission. And I'm always using it in the context of the business that I'm running, because I don't really think of myself as a business person. I don't even like the idea of being a business person necessarily. I think of myself as a creative or an artist. And I've had to trick myself into caring about business. And I loved hearing Dean point at the same thing. Like, I had to care enough. Remember, early on, the word was frugality. Like, I had to care enough. I had to be disciplined enough to earn permission to not care anymore. Because at the end, we got to freedom. So that's this phrase, like, profit equals permission. For me, the profit of the business just equals permission to continue to do projects I love, right? And what Dean is pointing to is this idea that income or money just equals permission. Income or money equals freedom to be careful and selective about the projects I take on. Because as he pointed out, he loves work. It's not about not working, right? It's about working on your terms. And I love that. I'm not sure. We have a little bit of a problem in some of these episodes that I just want to acknowledge and I'm aware of. There's a selection bias, a survivor bias in all of these episodes. We're talking to people who've been successful. And so if you've ever wondered about that as you listen to these episodes, well, easy for Chip Gaines to say or Dean Norris to say, realize I'm right there with you. Like, I realize this sort of survivor bias. For every Dean Norris, there are hundreds, if not thousands, of actors that committed to their craft that are still struggling or maybe never made it. And so I think all that points to is this is your journey, right? It's no one else's. And we touched on it earlier, the comparison. Instagram hasn't made this easier on us, right? There's always somebody doing better. There's always somebody doing worse. And the truth is, we don't even know how they're really doing. So your money journey is your money journey. As my friend Tim Maurer likes to say, personal finance is personal. So one thing you could do, and one thing I've been reminded to do based on this conversation with Dean, was to reconnect with what money means to me. Like, what's the purpose of it? Is it freedom? Is it security? Is it time with my family outside? Is it never being a burden to the kids, as somebody once said to me? In fact, I had somebody when I asked them what money means to them, what was important about money. Her answer was one word, cheese. And when I asked her to expand on it, she said, I want to be able to buy the fancy kind without worrying about it. So now would be a good time. It's a good time of year even to just reflect on what does money mean to you? See if you can reduce it down to just a sentence or two. Write it on a little note card. Let it serve as a reminder that personal finance is way more personal than it is finance. So thanks for listening. This has been another episode of 50 Fires. 50 Fires is a production of Blind Nil Audio in association with The Roost. My friends, if you find this show valuable, share it with a friend and leave a 6 or 7 star review on Apple Podcasts. It's crazy how much that helps the show get introduced to larger audiences. I'm Carl Richards. Thanks so much for listening, and I'll see you around the fire for our next episode.
The views, information, or opinions expressed in the series are solely those of the individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of Chip and Joanna Gaines, Blind Nil Audio, nor Magnolia.